United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Welcome to the Seminary Explores. I'm your host for today, Don Redman, and with me is Carla Christopher, a former poet laureate of York, Pennsylvania from 2011 to 2013. She's also been an educator, a case manager in domestic violence shelters, state prisons, and school districts. She then combined her belief in the power of the written and spoken word with her passion for activism, and among many other things too numerous to mention in full, she founded Equity Fest, a festival in celebration of LGBTQIA marriage equality, and she created a retailer cultural competency training model for urban renewal business districts. And this is only a small part of her personal and professional resume. Carla is also currently a student pursuing a Master of Divinity degree at United Lutheran Seminary. Carla, welcome to the Seminary Explorers.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
And we're glad to have you today. Now, you've brought a rather impressive list of experiences and advocacy with you to United Lutheran Seminary. And there is so much that we could talk about, but I think I'd like to start today with your work as a facilitator of difficult conversations, especially in the areas of race and LGBTQIA equality. And maybe just starting with how you came to take on that role of a facilitator in those kinds of discussions.
Sure. I actually started learning about how important people's experiences are in shaping the entire way they interact with the world. As a poet, I started doing a lot of workshops, working with young people, with kids, going into prisons and domestic violence shelters, helping women and children process a lot of really difficult things happening at that time. When I was poet laureate was when we first started seeing national publicity of police shootings. It's when we saw Mike Brown. It's when we saw Tayvon Martin. And there were young people in urban areas who I was teaching creative writing to, saying, "What do you want to talk about?" And they said, "The fact that I don't think I'm going to live to be 18. And as I was working in an artistic and cultural way with these young folks, helping them express and process and really create spaces where they could talk about what was going on in the world, how it was affecting their schooling, how it was affecting their family dynamics, I realized that the institutions around us are the things that make it possible for other good work to take root. So you can offer great faith-based care. You know, you can do wonderful church services. You can give great in-classroom experiences. But if folks are not feeling safe, if they don't have safe housing, if they don't have a family where someone is there able to help take care of them and offer them resources, you know, those things are not going to be able to benefit them in the way that can change their lives. So I got involved in activism, and I started becoming a person in the community saying we have to help folks get to the point where they can benefit from these programs and these great things that us do-gooders and helpers want to put out there. And as I was doing the activism work, really starting from a grassroots perspective based on relationship, I realized that nobody is just in one box. Intersectionality has become the big buzzword of what's going on in community-based activism and cultural competency, diversity education. And it really is about that the way a woman experiences the world can be different if you are a Black woman, a white woman, an immigrant woman, a disabled woman. We have to understand all the different things that make people up, and that we can't just say, well, this is how disabled women feel. This is how Black people feel. This is how Southerners feel. This is how poor people feel. Because we are made up of so much more than just one little thing. And so helping have conversations based on personal relationships, on where we're coming from as individuals, on what are the things that we have in common as humans, that all people have in common, but then also recognizing that we can only speak for ourselves and our personal experiences, and that we have to really learn how to listen thoughtfully and with open hearts and spirits to other people, even ones we think we know what they're all about. That gives us the foundation to have real conversations based on connection and not on the whole listening to respond and figuring out that we already know the answers. Those relationships, they change everything.
Yeah. How do you overcome maybe the resistance that people, often when a program like this is instituted in a school or an organization, it's because there has been something that's happened. And so it's a reactive situation. And so how do you overcome people's resistance to, oh, now I have to do this training?
Absolutely. The most common response when you go into any place, whether it's a school, a church, a business, and say, okay, it's time for diversity training, and you can see the groan just fighting its way out of the mouths of everyone that has to participate. So I try using creative phrasing. We've started talking about cultural competency or equity, but we'll also talk about relationship building or bridge building, finding positive phrases that talk about what we're trying to do, not just what we are. And then we also will do a lot of conversation around how can we get to know each other? How can we make this personally relevant to our situations? This is not just memorizing facts and being told what a horrible person you are. This is learning how you can celebrate other members of your community so that you can accomplish a common goal. And I go back to my arts background always. Culture is the things that bring us together in a group, right? We're not individuals. We are a group of people who enjoy spending time together. And that's how culture develops. So what do people love? What makes a culture? Food, music, poetry and arts, clothing and dance. So when I'll do diversity or cultural competency workshops, a lot of times I'll involve poetry, I'll involve storytelling, I'll involve cultural performances, make it feel celebratory and say, look, this is the reason our differences make life so entertaining and so much better, when it feels less like a punishment or an admonition and more like a celebration of all the things that we can learn and gain and do together and appreciate about each other. It tends to go down a lot easier.
Right. Do you see people beginning to at least outwardly open up when you're doing these trainings? People who maybe may have come in resistant, but when you go about it with this kind of more open, broader process, are you able to see changes? Or is it something you think is more long-term? They have to stew on it for a while and then...
Oh, I see changes happen the same day. You don't see the journey end, but you see someone take the first willing step. And that willing openness, that's the biggest thing. The couple big scene setters that I use is, the first thing you have to do is reassure the person that you're there with that you're not there to punish, criticize, or attack them. If folks are coming to this conversation defensive, that being defensive has to be disarmed. So I try to set safe spaces up. I use community agreements and say, these are the rules of engagement. This is how we're going to talk to each other. This is the space we're going to maintain. And it's all about use your I statements. Share personal stories only, not generalizations. Listen, don't talk over people, let them get their words out, but also then be willing to step back and make sure everyone has a chance to speak. When the space is defined and expectations are clear, people tend to feel safer and more comfortable. And then I also open up with some jokes, let people know I'll share a bit of my own personal story. I'm not just here to lecture, I'm here to participate and engage. And when I'm relaxed, when I'm having a good time, when I'm smiling, when I admit my own wrongs or my own failings or fears or challenges or areas of growth, it lets people know they have permission to be human in the space. One of my favorite community agreements is accept responsibility. Accept that your actions can hurt people or can cause damage, but also make the commitment to assume good intentions. We are here to be brave and to try. And we're not going to do it perfectly because we're doing something in many cases we've never done before. We cannot be wrapped up in such a fear of making a mistake that we are not willing to take a risk or be brave. We have to greet each other with love and grace. And that's why I love working in a Lutheran context or a church context more than any other, because I can say this is about grace. We have to have love and grace and practice reconciliation and forgiveness. And for the most part, people get that. And then once we have that humor and we have that openness and we have that safe space defined, then I go in with personal stories. It is much more life-altering for one person to tell their experience than it is to give sheet after sheet of statistics. And I had an amazing family come in. They are your typical suburban mom, dad, 2.5 kids. But they came to a poetry night of LGBTQIA teenagers because they wanted to be supportive, and I had asked them to attend. And as they were sitting there, the dad just started to weep. And all he could think about was hearing these teens. He said, "My daughter is your age. And the thought of you feeling unloved, feeling unsafe, that my daughter, in her vulnerability and her insecurity, if she ever felt that way, my heart would break for her. And so as a dad, my heart breaks for you." Now, I could have read a sheet of statistics about LGBTQIA youth suicide risk, heightened mental illness, depression, anxiety, but hearing a teen who reminded him of his daughter, sharing their story, that's what made the breakthrough. And we now have some rainbow pin coming out day celebrating, super affirming allies in a church community that did not start their journey there because of storytelling.
Right. Yeah, just that we're all human and that we all have the same experiences, you know, on some level, even if we don't have the same life.
Right. Those emotions are universal. Right. That sadness, that grief, that anger, that fear, that love, that joy. We might have different things that cause them, but if you can see the face of someone else's joy or hurt, you can find something in your life that parallels that. And maybe you can't understand it totally, but you can feel empathy. You can feel compassion. And that's all we really need to be willing to give someone else a break.
You spoke about churches and that just a few moments ago. And I'm wondering what advice maybe you could give to a pastor of a small rural congregation who wants to start having these discussions, but maybe can't afford to bring a facilitator in and is concerned about having it be a positive experience and not necessarily a negative one. How can they go about this on their own, or do they need to reach out and find support?
Sure. So one of the things I love about the ELCA is that we have so many resources that are available online that are easy downloads, specifically about conversations about race, conversations about inclusion or diversity. Especially the women of the ELCA have tons of downloadable resources that are free. Education is always a starting point and is always key. So I think faith formation spaces that engage our social statements, that engage the biblical justification for kindness, for nurturing the stranger, for bringing folks in, and giving real historical context to these Bible verses. When we learn how radical it was to sit down with someone with a disease or an illness, when we learn how earth-shattering it was for Paul to say, you know what, you don't have to be married. Your status is not determined by who you marry, because in that society it was. You know, these were calls for equality. These were calls for empowerment at that time. But it's not always immediately obvious to a person picking up the Bible and reading it without context. So I think that's where good biblical education and historical education can really help open people up without even realize that's what's happening. And hearing from the pulpit messages of equality are vital. Because the thing is, we don't actually know who's in our congregations. We might say, well, we don't have gay people in our congregation. Oh, I guarantee you do. And we don't know that just because it's a bunch of white faces, we don't know who their grandchildren are, who their children are. We don't know who their best friends are or their roommates. So to assume that we don't have that knowledge or that expertise or that population in our congregations is usually not the case. So by putting out some feelers, you find that there are allies, even in spaces that might seem like they are not. And then there is also that storytelling aspect where you can tell stories from the news, where you can bring in a mother who just lost her 12-year-old child for playing with a toy gun, when you don't make it a political conversation, but you say, imagine a 12-year-old child that you love. Imagine if you lost your life for every silly or reckless thing that you did. Bring it in language that people can identify with and understand, it does make it a little bit more real. It takes change and it takes time for folks to get there. But as we keep introducing little bits of these conversations, stretching and gently pushing and constantly educating, we can help open people up. And I do love bringing in guest preachers, guest speakers, cultural events. We have turned in the congregation that I serve, we have turned that space into sort of a town hub where we let different cultural groups come and hold events and use the space so that we can encourage our congregation members to attend. They might never have seen a spoken word night before, or Mexican dance, or tasted Dominican food. So by letting them engage in a non-threatening way, in a fun, celebratory way, and then strike up relationships and have conversations, they're like, wow, this is easier than I thought. It's not as scary or intimidating as it sounds if you can make it a natural exchange based on relationship building.
Okay. And I'd like to talk about your poetry in a moment, but I think I have one more question in this area. Mm-hmm. And you talked a little bit about language and creating a safe space when you're facilitating a group. And I'm wondering advice you might have to just the rest of us when we're out talking to just people we know, just having regular interactions. Sometimes because the public dialogue is not quite as gentle as what you try and create in your safe space, how can we have conversations without being afraid of using the wrong word or something that may be offensive to someone that we're not aware of?
Sure. And my favorite thing to do is just ask, because it is something that changes so quickly. And thanks to social media, thanks to the really global culture that we're a part of now, there are no universal answers to any questions. Some people prefer being Latino. Some say Hispanic. Some people love the phrase queer because it's a great phrase that expresses their complex and multiple identities. Others still feel that queer is a slur, and they're like, I prefer LGBTQIA+, or gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans. And there's lots of phrases that are being newly coined. So not everybody understands when you say, well, I'm non-binary or I'm cisgender. So if we're not sure, saying, I really want to support you, but I'm not sure what would be the best way for you. Can you just tell me what you prefer, what pronouns you'd like me to use, or how you'd like me to address you? 99% of people are going to feel grateful to be seen and for someone to care, and will extend that grace if given the opportunity.
So it sounds like it's kind of a combination of one, being willing to ask questions and put yourself out there from the side of the person who may not understand or may not know what words to use. And on the other side, maybe also being aware of intent and being
Absolutely.
Aware that even if a wrong word is used, maybe the intent wasn't there, you know, and then to bring it to that person's attention and say, you know, what you just said really isn't appropriate, and here's why.
Absolutely. And if we can listen without defensiveness and be able to say, okay, I can receive that feedback and I'm absolutely willing to go forward with that, it earns a lot of trust and credibility. We're talking with almost every marginalized group, people that have been told they're not valid, that their beliefs and their desires don't matter. So they may come across a little strong at first, not because they're angry at you, not because you deserve to be attacked, but because you're dealing with folks who have had to fight for the right to live, for the right to have basic legal and human rights. So it's hard sometimes to lay down that sword. And I can say that from personal experience, that I have to remind myself, hey, you're in a safe space right now. You don't have to fight here. So if you can extend, as the seeker, a bit of grace too, to the person you're speaking with who might seem defensive or angry or hostile, and recognize that it's coming from years of attack, both personal and institutional. And just let them know, hey, I'm here for you. If there's a way I can help, if there's something I can do, let me know. Just talk me through it. And that will sink in and it will make a change.
Well, thank you. Okay, so let's talk about poetry for a moment. And we'll change gears here real quick. And tell me a little bit about what it means and what the experience was like of being the Poet Laureate of York, Pennsylvania.
So being a government poet is something that many artists, it doesn't even compute. We're supposed to be about feeling and about seeing the world through unique eyes. But as Poet Laureate, you are the official poet for a city or a municipality or an entity, which means that your inspiration needs to be on their schedule and demand a lot of the time. So I would be called and be told, we're doing a ribbon cutting on a new city hall, and you need to write a poem about that within the next 2 weeks, and it needs to fit between 3 and 4 minutes, and it needs to be something that can be read out loud in a cold, outdoor, windy space in between an economic development specialist and the ribbon cutting from the board of the Women's Auxiliary. Go. And it was the greatest learning experience ever, because I learned how to preserve my own voice, but adapt it to the context and also to the listener. And it has been so beautifully helpful in preaching, because it's been about, what is my voice? What is my message? What do I believe? How do I feel the gospel revealing itself to me? How is the Holy Spirit telling me that I need to share this? But then also saying, I truly believe that a lot of Jesus' ministry was meeting people where they are at. How can I take what I feel is the truth of this text, but give it to folks in ways they can receive and understand, so that it doesn't just have meaning for me, but it has meaning for them too, because that's why I'm here. That's why I'm being given this trust by the church, and it's why I've been given a commission. It's not to go out and re-disciple myself every day. It's to go out and help other people become disciples as well. And they might be in a rural context, they might be urban, they might be super educated, they might be barely literate, they might be kids, and they might be senior citizens who have a very different life perspective and worldview. And I have to find a way to give the same gospel to all of them in a way they can receive it. And that to me was what being Poet Laureate was. So I have poems about everything under the sun, from buildings to books to certain holidays to regions. I was told to take the surrender of York in the Civil War, where we just said, hey, if we pay you off and feed you, will you not burn our town down? Because we can't really afford to rebuild it right now. And I was told, well, make that sound heroic. So I invented a whole story of bold businessmen and farmers who made the choice to sacrifice their own pride to protect the wives, the children, the parents who had sacrificed everything to help build these businesses, and that they were willing to go out and stand in front of raised guns and rolling cannon in peace, unarmed. And what courage might that take? Now, I had never thought about the surrender of York being particularly heroic. Mm-hmm. But when I was challenged to look at it through the eyes of those people in that time, I was able to see something I'd never seen before. So now when someone comes to me with a problematic Bible text, and a couple weeks ago I had to preach on, you know, the passage about divorced people are all committing adultery if they remarry. That's pretty problematic. But I was able to take a step back and say, what did this mean at the time? Well, at the time, it was talking about women who could simply be put aside with no money, no way to sustain themselves. And this is Jesus saying, you can't just put aside someone that you've claimed responsibility for. You have to make sure that each other are okay. You have to practice ethical behavior and care for one another. Well, I would never have seen that if I wasn't trained to look at things through new eyes and to put myself in other people's shoes. And that, for me, was what being a poet was all about.
Well, thank you. And I understand that you're at the end of an intensive week of studies here at the seminary, and that you've been doing a little bit of writing in the process, and I wondered if you maybe wanted to share a piece with us.
I would love to. It has been such a blessing taking a travel seminar throughout sites related to slavery and sites related to racial justice throughout Gettysburg, Philadelphia, Harper's Ferry, and what is the place of the church in the call for social justice? And so this is a piece, a very personal one, about how we can try to find a sense of connection in being joined into that one body of Christ, the one family that crosses races, genders, sexual orientations, slave or free, Greek or Jew. Lord, I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof, that my humbly assembled spirit should be accepted as proof of your created divinity. Only say the word, and my contract is sealed. Only say the word, and my soul can be healed, rebuilt from pebbles and silt into a palace of guilt and shame removed. Now the cornerstone of blame disproved, I am innocent in you. And laid down as your foundation, called to be the mother of nations for these skyscrapers, my children, horizon rising like the poems I've created, savior of our world. May this be the truth I impart into the word-tilled heart and fertile mind of our youth. We can soar where Jesus has led, following our exalted head, who, while followed by even one, is not dead, but risen in an Easter of peace and permission to go forth in our strength and sense of purpose, resurrected, recognition of each human's value expected, spirit to spirit. We can all be connected.
Thank you. Well, you've been listening to The Seminary Explorers, and our guest today is Carla Christopher, poet, activist, seminary student, and so much more. Thank you for joining us today, Carla. It was really a pleasure to speak with you.
This was wonderful. Thank you.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explorers, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.